So I said, I'm not telling, our company's better if we're a customer experience company. Our company's better if we have cultural contribution on the team. And it concerns me that I'm selling to organizations that have women and we have no women, but you go with it. So all they did was just bring in every female that had applied. Guess what happened? He came to my office. He's like, oh my gosh, there's terrific women out there. They're amazing. They have great skills. And I'm like, yeah. Like, we had to be very intentional about it. So in the next year, the complexion of our sales organization changed dramatically for the good. And the rest of the company saw, because remember, I have a lot of engineers, and finding female engineers, same type of a challenge. So we had to be very thoughtful about our process, and we had to go and recruit people to come, like we're zoo owners, you know, we gotta find exotic animals. The other thing that we did as a company is we signed up for what's called the Parity Pledge, that for every C-level position, that we will find and interview at least one qualified female candidate. Not hire, just interview.
Yeah.
And that was our pledge to our company and to our employees. And it was pretty amazing, the talent that we found.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it's really important, isn't it, bringing people off the page, off their CVs, because I think women are often penalized by perhaps staying in their roles longer, and therefore their salaries are lower, you know. And it's only when you actually meet these women and talk to them that you actually realize they're actually much better than men who are paid twice sometimes what they are. So you're right, it's bringing people off the page. But how do you help people come off the page if they might have an issue in an interview process? Because I would imagine some of your candidates might.
I think a lot of our candidates have an issue with the whole recruitment
Yeah.
process, not just the interview.
Yeah.
I mean, going back to sort of the selection process, a lot of neurodivergent people haven't had a traditional upbringing. They may have left school early because of the neurodivergent condition. They may have started university but dropped out because, again, because of the neurodivergent condition. And so they may have self-taught skills, but that doesn't reflect. If somebody's going through a traditional selection process, they'll see gaps because somebody's maybe been in a job where they haven't been supported properly, so they've had to leave, or they've maybe overworked, so they've had burnout, so again, they've left. So it could be lots of short-term jobs, or there could be gaps, or they could have self-taught skills. There's no degree as such for people to see, but they could be the best Python coder on the planet, but they have nothing on paper to reflect that. So I think it's seeing past what is on a CV. And in terms of the interview, I mean, interviews are horrible. They're just a test of people's social interaction skills in an unstructured environment. And even for anybody, it's not a comfortable experience. But neurodivergent people probably struggle more because of the condition. I mean, maintaining eye contact. Lots of people, if they want to listen to what somebody's saying, they won't look because they're concentrating on their hearing sense. Or if they want you to look at them, they'll give you eye contact, but they won't hear what you're saying. People don't understand that. And also, bright lights, a lot of noise, a lot of smells coming from a canteen. It's all very overwhelming for autistic people. So I think it's a case of making sure the environment that you interview somebody in is the right environment, it's calm, and they know what to expect. Giving people information in advance can be really, really helpful. It takes away some of the anxiety about the whole experience. I mean, it's not hard to send pictures. This is the room you're going to be interviewed in. This is the entranceway. This is the reception area. This is who you're going to meet. There'll be a panel. This is the person's name. This is the job title. This is the type of questions they're going to be asking. If people have that information in advance, it makes the whole experience much, much easier.
You know, I had a parent call me and say, my high school age son, I think he was 15, is so isolated. He's dropping out of school. He's a brilliant mind and a brilliant coder. He's self-taught. And I am so worried that he's so isolated, he is going to take himself off the ride. So can I pay you to pay him to work for you? And I said, no, but I'll pay him to work for me. This kid couldn't even drive himself to work, so dropped out of school. His mother drove him to work, and my team was like, she's lost her mind. this kid was one of the best coders that ever worked for me. And you know what? He's that engineer that moved to the Ukraine. And he is, so now he's a grown man and he's like fully functioning, but you know, he wants to live in the Ukraine because he's like, he doesn't want to talk to anybody. But our company that was acquired by someone else for a lot of money, I can take that DNA right back to that one kid. So bless the parents for having the guts to call me. Mm-hmm. And you know, we have to not be afraid to take a flyer on trying different things.
Yeah. And, but when you've got a big company like Lockheed Martin, you know, how do you maybe reskill the leadership team to bring people off the page and you know to interview people perhaps they wouldn't normally interview?
Yeah, I think you're right. You have to do strategies like, you know, recruit from with women to women, right, and promote successful examples. So we have programs where we're recruiting from the high schools. It's hard to get women who are largely unrepresented in manufacturing. Mm-hmm. And we have video testimonies of people that their lives have been changed and women that have been very successful and actually perform better than the men do in most cases with regard to you know, developing components and building aircraft.
Yeah.
And so promote those kinds of things. Mentoring is a huge component. So getting our female engineers or, you know, people in the classroom and doing mentoring and giving them, you know, opportunities to really build the confidence to come in and say, yeah, I can do that job.
Yeah.
And I can do it better than, in some cases, the men.
And I think there's an issue, isn't there, persuading people to come back into the workplace as well.
Yeah.
You know, if they've stepped out for caring responsibilities, persuading them to come back. We worked with Microsoft because you know they have a great graduate entry, pretty equal actually, but then when you get to the leadership positions, it just drops off. So they asked us to look and find talented women who might want to step back into the workforce and just have that ongoing conversation, see where they were, see when they were ready to come back, and then pop them back in. And you know, I think we're going to have to look for different ways of doing that in the future, aren't we?
Yes. Maybe COVID helped us there, yeah? Because it forced us to work remotely.
Yeah.
Actually, that's something that is there to stay now. If you really want to be an employer of choice, I think that hybrid working mode, huh? Leaving people to choice, trusting them to work partly from home and coming into the office,
but
opens up opportunities for women that don't necessarily have the flexibility to work 9 to 5 because they have to take care of different things, but that opens a broader range of people that are not comfortable coming into the office or not mobile because of a disability, or people that work in more rural areas that are just too far away from the city centre to come in every day, but that are happy to travel in just once a week or twice a week. So it really, from a location assessment perspective, I think, broadens the whole radius from where you can actually tap into a much broader labour force altogether.
So are you noticing really that when companies are looking to relocate, they're using, and obviously it depends on the company, but they're using the site as a meeting space, as more and more.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah, exactly. So it's all about finding that right balance, because you want your workforce to have the flexibility to work from home. Of course, the technology has to be there because that's not as easy in every part of the world.
No.
Infrastructure needs to be there in terms of mobility solutions for people to travel in. But at the same time, you want to have an office that is not these cubicles anymore, where you have a fun place where people come in, where they can exchange, work in an agile way, share knowledge, transfer that knowledge, build that corporate culture. So it's all about how you find that right balance and how much of a percentage of the time do I expect my people to be there.
Yeah.
And that's different for each and every company, of course.
And so we don't think it's going to go back to 9 to 5 in an office?
Definitely not.
No?
Definitely not.
I think some companies will try to shoehorn it back to the way it was. And everybody's got to run their own company. But I don't know that those companies will be the companies of the future that people will want to work for.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some aspects of the job. I mean, certainly we have jobs where you have to be physically there for the time, or you're working in a classified environment, so the requirements of the job. But, you know, 60% of our workforce is telecommuting now, and we have 4-10s every Friday off. And within that context, flexible work schedules so that people can decide, hey, they need to go do this, and they just go do that, and they get the job done, and they deliver quality product. And if you don't hold them to, you have to sit at that computer 9 to 5, and we better see your face.
Yeah.
And it requires us to be better managers, really. It requires us to be better CEOs, better leaders, because we have to be very clear and precise about what the job expectations are.
Well, I was going to ask you that, because how do you keep productivity high?
So productivity, you know, I'm fascinated with productivity, because if you look at the Gallup poll, they do it, like they interview like 50,000 people across the planet, and then they give their productivity scores. And the United States, 33%, which I was like, how can it be that bad? Like, it just seems like, what are people just doing Facebook all day long? Like, it just seems like nothing's getting done. But this was self-reported how productive people think they are. The tougher numbers are in Asia, like 9% productivity. If you think about it, they're very rigorous structure, and you do what you're told, and there's like a pecking order. So that makes sense to me. People can't be innovative. They can't just go and do things. So if we can look at our teams and say, look, if we can move productivity a couple of points, it's meaningful. One of the companies I was hired to come in was in the ditch, and so I took this to heart. 33% productivity, I got rid of a third of the company. Not a hiccup. And I was like, oh, maybe I can get rid of more, because I was trying to get the company to pay attention to different things that we needed to do. If you can get your workforce to be as productive as you can and that they love it there, then you have a chance of continuing to grow. And for me in tech, I'm looking for big growth numbers all the time, because it's death if we're not growing, if we're not engaging customers, if we're not continuing to innovate.
Yeah.
I think engaging is a key word too, right? You know, engagement with the workforce, to check in, to just see how people are doing, to really care about them and you know, outside of work, and value the work that they do, and
yeah.
And give them an understanding of how they fit into how their job contributes to even the financials, yeah. Where the company is going, right? And yeah. That gives them that feeling of being part of something. And that's, I know that's appreciated by our workforce.
Yeah. I think a lot of neurodivergent people have traits that lend themselves to high productivity. I'm going to throw a stat out here. JP Morgan Chase have found that their autistic employees demonstrate 48% faster job performance and are 92% more productive. So, I mean, that's amazing. I mean, a lot of the cognitive skills that many neurodivergent people have, things like pattern recognition, error detection, attention to detail, and sustained concentration, just means they go into a job and they do the hyper-focus. I mean, you think about Silicon Valley, I mean, it's full of autistic coders who, they spend 24 hours a day just coding, and they don't realize what the time is. And there's not many neurotypical people that can have that level of focus and productivity.
Yeah.
So I think if organizations have a diverse workforce, you bring these people in, and that maybe sort of sets a standard. People think, well, they're performing at this level, maybe I could up my game a bit.
Yeah.
Well, I think if we turn it back on ourselves, right? If I have an employee that's not productive, it's on me, right? Because I assume people are smart, they want to do a good job, they don't want to get fired. Like, those are my basic tenets. And if they're not doing what I need them to do, then I haven't been clear about what the expectation is or what I need to have done specifically, or they don't have the capacity or the capability to do something, and I put them in the wrong job. But I think when I fire someone, they already know they're getting fired. Like, it's not gonna be a surprise, because I've given them like tremendous feedback. And in most of my companies, I talk about courage over comfort, that if we as an organization can have courage over comfort, that we can have conversations, that people deserve to know if they're succeeding or failing. They deserve to know what their expectation is, and that the people that understand that, they do a great job of building great teams.
Yeah, and I think this, innovation is going to be the key for successful companies, isn't it? And to do that, you need perhaps disruptive intelligence. So people who are going to question in your workforce. And is that something that a company like, let's say, Lockheed Martin, an established, older company, welcomes? Because I would imagine, Corinne, your companies are full of people who say, no, I'm not sure about that. No, let's do this, let's do that. Well, it's more difficult.
No, absolutely. I mean, that is how you innovate, is to listen, right? And everyone gets a voice, and contributions are welcome and encouraged. And, you know, so you have to promote that as part of an inclusive environment.
Yeah.
People feel like they can contribute.
Yeah.
And you have to do things to kind of mix it up. So in my companies, we have what's called a hackathon. So everyone knows once a quarter, we're going to spend 2 days. We're going to stop, drop, and roll, because for 48 hours, I want you to come up with ideas and things that you don't have time to do in your regular job, but an idea for a product or an invention, or, and the top prize, 10 grand. And they're killing themselves, and they've already built teams, and they're like staging a coup. And then, you know, we've had some pretty amazing things come out, not just from the guy that wins, but it just keeps the, it's special for them. Like, they love it. They bring their sleeping bags, they sleep in the conference room, there's lots of pizza and crap, but like, I don't understand it, but they love it.
Yeah, and I think that's a challenge, isn't it? Because with remote working, you know, keeping the company together, keeping that connection, to begin with, a lot of companies found that very challenging. You know, and we certainly went through a phase of lots of companies wanting strategic HR directors all of a sudden. Not just HR directors, but they had to be strategic. They had to be in the room thinking. Then suddenly it was replacing lots of CEOs who clearly weren't up to coping with it. Then it was lots of digital people. So it's, you know, it's finding ways to cope, first of all, once you've got the company up and running, to actually keep that connectivity. So, you know, how do we reimagine the structure to keep those connections going when you're going to have people working remotely, working flexibly, and perhaps, well, hopefully, diverse talent who might have different needs? How do you keep that connection going?
Yeah, as part of our digital transformation initiatives, you know, that we have platforms that enable this collaboration from Zoom to Teams to, you know, various platforms. Our social platform is a single pane of glass. Slack, the use of Box for, you know, just all of these various tools that I think help, but really it's that collaboration, it's that coming together, even in a remote work environment that's driving that, that step forward.
And I think don't underestimate the power of community service. Don't underestimate the power of having your team turn outside and looking for things that are important to them to give back. So if you have a day of service, or if you say, all right, we're going to focus on child literacy this month, we're going to donate books, we're going to read to children, like, everyone, think of ways that you can contribute to this where you sit, where you are. We're going to look at hunger in our community. My team, they have ideas. They're like, look, let's collect all the old blue jeans and give them to the... It's like, okay, great idea, terrible idea, but great idea, right? It's like, just we try everything, but everyone gets to contribute. And while it may feel chaotic, it actually braids people together because they can see their contribution and they can learn from each other. And I think that companies underestimate the power of giving back as a company.
Yeah. And How do you ensure that your neurodivergent talent workforce feels connected to the company?
I guess it's speaking to them as an individual, because they are all individual. Some prefer more social communication than others. We found that a lot of organizations that we work with have employee support groups. I think they're really valuable because people can then connect out with their day-to-day role. They can talk about their disability, their mental health, their neurodivergent condition, whatever that employee support group is about. So they're really valuable. And at Oticon, we have a monthly social group, so we'll go out and we'll bring them all together and do something socially, like a games night, a cinema night, just so they feel part of a team, even though they're all working in their bedrooms remotely. So I think it is important to have that connection.
Yeah. So,
I'd just like to also say, you know, we still recognize the value of bringing people together.
Yes.
You know, even though we're working remotely,
yeah.
You know, where it works for the employee and works for the company, and you know, it's carefully planned. I know, you know, I'm looking forward to our strategic team planning event that's coming up in Florida, where we're all coming from various parts of the states together for the first time in like almost 2 years. Mm. And so you know, I think that's going to be a valuable experience because of that networking, the opportunity to really give back, do some of the things, other things, and have fun and celebrate our successes.
Yeah. And do you find, Patsy, do you find that companies really are sort of agonizing over whether to have a location and have people and try and push people back into that location? Or do you, and are they asking you advice as to whether they should be offering flexibility as one of the most important parts of their decision making?
Yeah, well, companies sometimes have thought, well, with this whole change, we can go for fully virtual operations.
Yeah.
I'm not a strong believer in that. I would be out of business, of course. But I still believe, indeed, in the strengths of bringing people together, even if it's not all the time. But otherwise, how do you create a connection and loyalty also? That's what you build in with your corporate culture. So,
yeah.
And then where you find the balance, I think that really depends based on where you are and what expectations are in that local context, but also based on what you as an organization want to bring forward. So.
And When companies approach you, what is their, you know, what are the, let's say, a couple of the typical questions that you found post-COVID that they've been asking you?
Skills. It's definitely all around skills. Well, actually, since COVID, we have been developing a whole, what we call a transformation drivers framework. It has 36 key drivers that have had major impact on how companies operate and where they operate. I'm not going to go to all 36 of them, but a lot of them actually have connections with skill factors. So the whole digitization agenda, AI, we've touched upon that. Now you need skills that were not there a couple of years ago. They're in very high demand. They're not available anywhere. So you have to think differently in terms of how do you build those skills, where do you tap into.
Yeah.
The next gen, which has its challenges, the whole aging population also, which puts, again, pressure on the workforce.
Yeah.
So all of those dimensions are really making it quite complex. And I think
people are thinking ahead, because I was talking to Jackie from Lloyds Bank yesterday, and she was saying how in Dundee they're working closely with the universities to train up,
yeah,
particularly, you know, tech people, but it's going to be 2 years.
Yeah.
So you can plan ahead, but that doesn't help for now, does it?
Exactly, yeah. And that links back to the whole branding. If you don't have a big brand, if you can do things like that, work with university, to at least create trust and name recognition very early on for your future workforce. And okay, you have to wait for them, but then at least you have them in your pocket by the time you get out.
Yeah.
When we spend time in the classroom, like my executives, I want them in front of those students, talking to them about how great it is to be in tech, how much money you can make, how flexible your life is. And a lot of young people don't see themselves in tech because they think, oh, I have to be a coder. And it's not the case. Like, I need every child to have access to computer science so that they can learn coding, not because I need them to be coders, but because I need them to be computational thinkers. And I think a lot of young people, especially young women, don't see themselves in tech. And that's a mistake, because it's a great place to be. And it's a great place for, like, my Asperger's, I love those guys because it's easy to communicate with them. But I need everyone. So I'm a big fan of having companies support your local universities to be in the classroom, to be working with the deans of the business departments, the computer science department, engineering department, so that these kids can visit their future. Because the more that they can see women, handsome men, doing things that they can see themselves that way, because unfortunately a lot of young people can't be what they can't see. And a lot of their parents, like my mother wanted me to be a hairdresser. I couldn't be farther from a hairdresser than like you could ever imagine. And I'm still a huge disappointment to my mother, but it's okay, because I bought her a house. But she doesn't understand, like she doesn't think I do anything. And so, you know, my mother's great, but she wasn't gonna help me really achieve the things that I was super nerdy, so I ended up this way. But we need to help young people see the potential that they have. Otherwise, we're never gonna get out of some of the challenges that we have.
And I think we need to rephrase how we box certain jobs, certain careers, certain titles, because, you know, if you use, without even thinking about it, you might use gender biased language.
Right.
And people don't realize how creative the tech industry is. And, you know, creativity generally appeals to women generally more than men. But that's not how it's phrased in adverts and things like that, is it?
Job requisitions and job postings. We have had to really look at that in our recruiting approaches and tools and make sure we take that bias out.
Yeah.
And this is a problem that's going to be with us for a while because there are fewer women in math, computer science, STEM education, STEM degrees than there were in the 70s. And that's a problem and that's a mistake. And it's going to take us a long time to solve for it. So one of the things that I've been working on with our local universities is stackable credentials. A lot of young people are like, four-year degree, out, right? Can't afford it, don't have time, and you're going to pay me a lot of money to be a barista, right? So why would I go to college? So I need people that are in food services to be able to see themselves in tech and to go to a local university and to be able to study for a bit and get a certification that they can be an IT certified, and then after they have so many certifications, they can actually have an associate's degree.
Yeah.
Oh, and guess what? You can actually have a four-year degree. Because the time's gonna go by no matter what, and the more that we can educate our young people and to help them be in jobs where they can actually earn more than a living wage, then the better our communities are gonna be, and then we won't have to struggle with so much homelessness or hunger or single moms below the poverty level. I mean, these problems that just keep being persistent.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that communication between industry and education is so important, and skills signaling and going down early in the pipeline and really creating that pathway from secondary to post-secondary. And to your point, you know, credentials of value to industry, and it doesn't have to be a degree program. It can be a certificate or, you know, a six-week employer-sponsored training, pre-employment training program or something of that nature.
Well, I mean, I can carry on asking questions for hours here, but as promised, does anybody have any questions that they'd like to ask the panel? Do we have a microphone en route? There we go.
Good day. I'm Arna Gudmundsson from Business Iceland. I have a question for you because talent attraction is absolutely key for all IPAs and regional economic development agencies. So, can you give us an example of an incentive scheme for talent attraction or training support that actually has worked well, in your opinion?
John or Corinne, probably?
I can start.
Okay.
Because I have such a demand for engineering talent, my engineering team, I said, look, I will buy you Pluralsight licenses. Pluralsight is a company that you can do your own online training. You can learn as many languages as you want, coding languages. And it has this massive curriculum. And my engineers, for them, that was like their most valued asset at the company, because I said to them, look, you're not gonna be with me forever because you're a millennial, you're gonna leave me in 3 years. But I care about you, so the one thing you're gonna leave when you leave me is you're gonna leave with more education, more languages. And so word got out that I was paying for these licenses for engineers, so I had people applying for jobs because they wanted to have that license that they could study as often or as much as they wanted to get training and certification for different tech languages. Also, word got out that, look, I care about your education because my personal bias is toward education. So my poor kids, they'll be in school forever. But they, you know, education has solved a lot of problems for me. So I pay for education for my employees, even if it's during the work day. And they know that the one thing that they leave with when they leave me is that certification, that degree, because I want them always to have better jobs, and they may not be with me. But when people leave me, guess what happens? They come back. And I'm very proud of that. But I think as companies and as organizations, we need to be really clear about, look, this is what differentiates me from everyone else, and that's how you can recruit and steal really cool people.
Is your question not more about what you as an economic development organization can offer in terms of incentives, right? Yeah. There's the likes of the job creation incentives, of course. Huh? If you create a job, and do you assign that to specific jobs where you, for instance, can, as an organization, put more emphasis on diversity, not just on unemployed people, but maybe why not people which have somewhat of a different background where you can get an additional grant? And also, of course, training support is something that is commonly out there. But also there, how do you build it in such a way that it becomes interesting for all the parties involved, for the company, but also for the candidate as such? Well, for instance, if you have to go through a 6 or an 8 week program and the war for talent is out there, maybe some of these guys will not sit through it unless if you actually pay them a salary while they're going through this education. So then the chance of them leaving to start working instead of sitting through the training is again something that can help there. So those are small things I think that can help and that build a win-win-win situation for all parties involved, I would
think. Yeah, that equitable public-private partnership is really important. Employers have a significant investment in developing the employee, but if we can bring education and employee and industry together, we can really solve something that creates, like apprenticeship model, where they don't have all of the competencies coming in, but we can make that investment in developing them and give them a tiered wage structure and a progression toward coming in to a successful job.
And we did that in our state. So during COVID, we had a lot of displaced workers from our food services. And so we went to our largest university, which has 45,000 students, called Utah Valley University. And the state put in quite a bit of money, and they offered 25 different certification programs that were mostly in tech. We're actually adding more now around mortgage loan officers, things that real estate, to help people get a fast track into a job that's different than their current job.
I think there was another question.
Hi, fantastic panel and really very thought-provoking. I kind of resonate with my colleague from Iceland. I come from Frankfurt, and we're all from Frankfurt, and the issues we have are also budget issues. I mean, this sounds great with training, sounds great that you invest in your people, but we work on really, really tight budgets since we are partly government-owned. Now, thanks to that, we don't have the same measures of growth and productivity that that you guys have as corporates. We measure productivity differently, pretty much intangible, actually. Now we have tight budgets. It's not, our salaries are not determined by the growth or productivity of the company or the organization. And third, you have something like a pandemic coming in where we cannot even go out and reach people or network with people. And because of that, we have a severe skill shortage. We do not have as many people wanting to come to us because, on one hand, government-owned, so there's very little chance for growth in an organization. And then we're also not giving a lot of salaries to our people. I mean, it's a lot for the government agency, but, in comparison to your salary, what you would give a fresher, my CEO probably earns that much, and that's not even a joke. So how do you work in this disruption? And we need these new people because you said that you are working in a constantly dynamic and ever-changing environment. And if we have a 60-year-old, no biases here, but if we have a 60-year-old talking to one of your Koreans, one of your employees, which is 25, fully tattooed, the communication just goes off. And we're trying to exactly attract your innovative people to our region. Now, how do we work around this disruption and these times?
So I can take a stab at it. I do have people in my ecosystem that want to solve really big problems. So I have an organization in my state that's focused 100% on helping single moms. They don't pay a ton, but one of my employees, that's a passion of theirs. And so to know that and to be able to connect them, I think that you're gonna have a really hard job. So you're gonna have to do the training yourself. You're gonna have to educate yourself and you're gonna have to work with a 60-year-old to say, look, I know they look like they're a mass murderer, but I promise you, we need this person because of their skill set or because of what they're willing to walk away from a high paid job because they care about their community, they care about giving back. Remember what I said earlier, they'd rather have a job that's meaningful to them than to make a big salary. They do have to make a living wage, but if you can help people understand their impact and how they're making a big difference in their government. I'm the chair of the governor's office of economic development for my state. It's a volunteer job. It gives me brain damage. but I love the fact that I can help direct some of our state, not be the worst state for women. Make sure we take care of people that are below the poverty level. Make sure, because in my community, if tech does well, we had $50 billion in liquidity events in our state last year. We have 3 million people. And people think Utah's a backwater. It's like, yeah, underestimate us all day long. But the problem is if tech does really well, but the rest of my community and my state doesn't, then we will have failed. And so we have our founders and entrepreneurs understand that. And so, again, you've got to have a partnership with people like us and find those people that want to make sure that Frankfurt is great. I grew up in Heidelberg, by the way. We have an organization in our state called Silicon Slopes. It's a nonprofit. And the whole aim is to learn, connect, and serve. So we're connected with our state government. It's probably how I got the chair gig. But we know as executives that we can actually make a difference in our community because the state doesn't have enough money, because there are not enough budgets. So we paid for computer science in every classroom in our state because our state couldn't do it.
Our computer screen has gone red, oops, which means the time is up. So I'd like to thank a fantastic panel, and you've given us lots to think about. So
thanks, Laurie. It was good.
Thank you all. What a great session. Thank you so much. Thank you so much, panelists and moderator. We love hearing about all the challenges that we can collectively share and share solutions. Our next session will begin at 11. It is on health tech. You do not want to miss that. We're going to welcome back Renee Buck. And his organization, Buck Consultants, is our sponsor. During the networking break over in the exhibit area, please do us a favor and visit our sponsors from Chad. They had difficulties traveling. They weren't able to be here yesterday. They are here now, and so they're looking forward to meeting as many people as they can. And so with that, we look forward to seeing you back in here at 11. Thank you.